It is Monday, May the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, venue for the U.S.-North Korea summit all set.
Now we know it is indeed Singapore, which to a lot of people makes quite a bit of sense.
U.S. travel restrictions on Pakistani diplomats, plus the 70th anniversary of the Israeli independence just ahead.
Altogether, it's a great place. Almost 9 million people living there as opposed to about 650,000 in 1948.
And also ahead, some sounds from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has announced his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be taking place in Singapore on June the 12th. He made the announcement on Twitter just hours after he personally welcomed home three Korean Americans freed by North Korea. During the event at a U.S. Air Force base just outside of Washington, Mr. Trump boarded the jet bringing home the three men who had been imprisoned in North Korea.
My proudest achievement will be, this is a part of it, but will be when we denuclearize that entire peninsula. This is what people have been waiting for a long time. Nobody thought we could be on this track in terms of speed. So I'm very honored to have helped the three folks. They're great people. You know, I got to speak to them on the plane. These are great people. They've been through a lot, but it's a great honor. But the true honor is going to be if we have a victory in getting rid of nuclear weapons.
My colleague Sarah Williams asked VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman whether the White House gave any reason for Singapore as the location of the summit.
No, there has not. I tried to ask Sarah Huckabee Sanders at yesterday's daily briefing about what were the criteria of the United States for the site selection, and she deferred answering that. But now we know it is indeed Singapore, which to a lot of people makes quite a bit of sense. Both the United States and North Korea, which do not have diplomatic relations with each other, do have embassies in Singapore. It has the type of infrastructure, logistics, and communications to be able to handle high-level talks like this, along with the thousands of journalists that will also come along. And perhaps most importantly, it does appear to be within range of the plane that Kim Jong-un recently used to go from Pyongyang to Dalian, China. So he would be able to get in that aircraft from North Korea to Singapore without refueling.
Yeah, because I believe he and other members of his family are not exactly what you could say keen flyers.
Traditionally, North Korean leaders have traveled about by train in their own country and then on trips to China, and rarely have North Korean leaders ventured beyond the train tracks.
Well, now this announcement comes just after three Americans who were detained by North Korea have been released, and President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump welcomed them at Joint Base Andrews, and I believe you were there when they returned.
Well, it was an extraordinary scene because the president usually ends his evenings quite early, and if he does go out, for example, to dinner at his nearby hotel, he usually seems to be back by about 10 p.m. So to see him and the First Lady, as well as the Vice President and the Second Lady, out at Andrews at 3 o'clock in the morning was something really remarkable. But perhaps the most encouraging aspect of that was that these three U.S. citizens were able to walk down the stairs from the plane with the president and first lady, who went on board briefly to talk to them, unaided. They appeared to be in very good shape, considering their ordeal. Obviously, a much better outcome than with Otto Warmbier, the University of Virginia student from Cincinnati, who essentially came back in a coma after his arrest in North Korea.
And I believe these three, they're undergoing medical evaluations at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center.
Correct. They were taken in a van directly to Walter Reed for evaluation and medical checkups. There were none of their family members at Andrews to greet them, and that's pretty much in keeping with a protocol for Americans returning from long periods of imprisonment abroad. Authorities will also want to debrief them pretty much before they have contact with family members and friends.
That is VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, and he was speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
United States is imposing travel restrictions on Pakistani diplomats starting today. VOA Asia's David Byrd speaks with correspondent Aman Azhar of the VOA Urdu service about his conversations with the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., plus these travel restrictions. Here's David Byrd.
Run down for me real quick what these travel restrictions do and why are they being imposed?
Well, first of all, there's a background to it. The U.S. embassy staff in Pakistan have been having this complaint for a while now that they're facing some kinds of travel restriction back in Pakistan, and it's apparently been tolerated. It's nothing really happened back in the United States, but this time around, under the Trump administration, for the first time, we've seen that there's been a reciprocity, that the formal restriction have been imposed on the diplomatic staff from the Pakistan consulates and embassies here in the United States. So there was a lot of speculation in the air earlier on for the last 2 months or so. And finally today, when I spoke with the ambassador, Azhar Chaudhry, he's an outgoing ambassador, he confirmed that, yes, indeed, the Pakistan's diplomatic staff is now under travel restrictions, which kind of restrict them from moving beyond a certain limits from the embassy and the consulates. And if they want to proceed beyond that, they're going to have prior kind of a bureaucratic paperwork has to be done and put in so that they can move beyond that point. So now there's, according to Ambassador, this is not going to help in kind of forging the bilateral relation that both the countries are trying to do, which is on a downhill for a long time now.
And this also comes at a time when President Trump has announced that the United States will pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Pakistan is a nuclear power, and they are an ally in the region. Why do you think the Trump administration, or why did the ambassador say the Trump administration would take steps like this?
Well, David, it has to go to Afghanistan, or the kind of a cooperation that the United States has been wanting Pakistan to extend. Now, cutting the long story short, the Trump administration is not happy with the way Pakistan has been delivering or not able to do exactly what the U.S. administration wants. This has been a long-term issue. Also, it goes before the present administration, but this is for the first time that the Trump administration has actually taken the steps which previous administrations have not really done. So this is like upping the ante in various ways. So this is like a message being sent to Pakistan that this time around there are different players in the office here in the United States and that they are willing to go beyond where previous administrations have not gone. So it has to do also with the kind of cooperation which the U.S. administration is trying to extract from Pakistan in terms of bringing some sort of stability in Afghanistan, too.
That is correspondent Aman Azhar, the VOA Urdu service, speaking with VOA Asia's David Byrd. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi,
I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. On Monday, Israel will be marking 70 years since it was established as a state on May 14, 1948. Torchlighting ceremonies expected to begin the Independence Day celebrations that will include, of course, dancing concerts and lots of fireworks. Also expected to be the day the United States officially opens its relocated embassy in Jerusalem. Carved out of Palestinian territory following World War II and at the end of the British Mandate, Israel has become home to the Jewish diaspora and has become an economic success story as well, rivaling Western Europe. But its people, surrounded by Arab states, face a host of security challenges. Joseph Olmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty and called the Jewish state one of the world's great success stories of the past seven decades.
Because from a state that was engaging in a war for its own existence, it became a regional superpower with an economy which is stronger than many economies in the world. You know that the per capita income in Israel is higher than that of Britain and France, with great educational and health systems, a strong army. Altogether, it's a great place. Almost 9 million people living there, as opposed to about 650,000 in 1948. Altogether, the sense of many Israelis is that they live in a country that has been succeeded in many respects, though confronting a lot of difficulties, a lot of challenges, but still a country which is so exceptional in the overall neighborhood of the Middle East, you know, where instability and civil wars and violence are the order of the day.
Of course, Israel faces a number of security challenges. Is Iran the biggest threat?
It may be the biggest threat now, and as we talk, by the way, there may be some interesting developments along the border between Israel and Syria involving Iranian provocations against Israel, but altogether the Iranian threat, as big as it is, it's a temporary one because it's not so clear to me why the Iranian people would, for too long, accept a regime that engages itself in conflicts all over the Middle East as opposed to dealing with the problems of Iran. So I would expect changes in Iran itself. I think that the real problem that Israel is confronting is the idea that there should be some kind of peaceful accommodation between Israel and the Palestinians.
Prime Minister Netanyahu is welcoming what he calls the real seeds of peace that he said were beginning to sprout among some of Israel's Arab neighbors. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah. You know, when you hear today the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the way he talks about the Arab-Israeli conflict, it's like heaven and earth. It's a huge difference from what it used to be. And it's Saudi Arabia, you know, the country where the holy places of Islam are in Mecca and Medina. And Saudi Arabia, with all its economic prowess and might and all that, there is peace with Egypt. One thing is to talk about that. Another thing is to expect formal, say, peace treaties between Israel and more Arab countries on top of the ones that Israel has with Jordan and Egypt. That is something to be desired. It's not going to happen in the immediate future.
Paraguay has announced it's becoming the third country to move its embassy to Jerusalem. How significant is that?
Part of the process. There's no question that the historic decision of President Trump to move the embassy of the U.S. to Jerusalem, which is Israel's capital, is opening the doors for more countries to do so. The Czech Republic is opening a consulate in Jerusalem, and they say it's the beginning of a process that would lead them to move the embassy. Romania is considering it, and we know about some other countries in Central and South America and perhaps in Africa. The gates were open, you know, and it's not a flood, but it's the beginning of a process.
Joseph Olmert, political science professor at the University of South Carolina, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, As Burundi prepares for a May 17th referendum to extend President Pierre Nkurunziza's time in office, it battles allegations of harassment committed against perceived opponents of the referendum. Critical times in Burundi on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
More than 15,000 refugees are on five Greek islands, and there is a huge backlog of asylum requests to be processed. Authorities say it could take several months to go through the backlog, saying more staff and shelters for refugees are needed. We get more now on the migrants making their way to Greece from Reuters' Anna Bevan.
As dawn breaks over the waterlogged plain of Evru on the border between Greece and Turkey, a line of refugees emerges through the morning haze. They've made it across the Evru River, which is fast becoming the preferred route for migrants crossing into Europe. Omar Walid is from Aleppo. He fled Syria 6 months ago after losing his father and son.
I'm very tired. It's very bad. Here it's very good, but the way it's very bad.
In April alone, at least 2,900 people arrived in Greece through these waters. That's already half the estimated number for the whole of 2017, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Police and local government officials in the region are concerned. In 2015, nearly a million refugees and migrants crossed from Turkey to Greece's islands. But that route all but closed after the EU and Ankara agreed to stop the flow in March 2016. This land border doesn't appear to fall under the agreement. It takes around 5 to 6 minutes to paddle across the Evru River, a much favoured route compared to the harrowing journey and overcrafted rafts to make it to Greece's islands. But these fast-moving waters are still treacherous. 12 people died here in the first 3 months of the year. Those who do survive the crossing are taken to be registered and given a 3-month residence permit. Theoretically, they're free to move around Greece, unlike those on the islands.
That is Reuters' Anna Bevan reporting. Also in the news, when Facebook recently said it would undergo civil rights reviews, civil liberties and human rights activists politely applauded. For years, activists have called on tech companies to undergo assessments of how their policies and decisions affect human rights globally. Facebook civil rights audits come as a shareholder group also pushing companies to do more about human rights, and lawmakers and regulators are discussing ways to rein in tech firms. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Addressing affordable living in Perth, Australia with micro-housing, mini-size apartment complexes with mini-size apartments. Banking analyst Brian Johnson.
You've either got to have great public transport or you've got to be very close to where the jobs are. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
A single lot with several micro-housing units will be 80 square meters, equivalent to 3 shipping containers side by side, or nearly 5 times smaller than a typical building lot. They'll be placed in open urban sites where small living units might thrive, and buyers can choose a 1 or 2 bedroom unit, which includes ownership of the land, for $225,000. The pilot program is backed by the Western Australia government, Housing Minister Peter Tenley.
It's part of the answer about getting affordable housing across the city around those transport-orientated developments.
The first lots for sale hit the market in May. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
You'll never find, as long as you live, someone who loves you like I do.
No doubt that's Lewis Allen Rawls, better known to most of us as Lou Rawls. He began singing at the age of 7 at the Greater Mount Olive Baptist Church on the south side of Chicago. He later sang with local groups where he met other stars in the making like himself. Sam Cooke and Curtis Mayfield remained friends with Lou Rawls throughout their careers. Mayfield died in 1999, Cooke in 1964, and Rawls in 2006.
one else. You'll never find
another love like mine was one of Rawls' biggest hits, topping charts not only in the U.S. but around the world when it was released in 1974.
The rhythm, the rhyme, all the magic we shared, just us two.
Frank Sinatra once said that Rawls had the classiest singing and silkiest chops in the singing game. In 1986, Sinatra, who had just turned 71, appeared on Lou Rawls' TV special, Parade of Stars.
I have been a follower, an avid fan of yours since day one, and I have always wanted to sing with you. I have sang songs that you have sang before me, and I want to sing one with you so that I can say I have sang with the chairman of the board.
It's about time you said it, because I was getting lonely up here.
Please. Yeah, buddy. Let's try one. We'll do it. Yeah, that's a good one.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you all the way.
Yeah. How's about she's happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you? Come what may.
The road will lead us, only a fool would dare say.
Yeah.
You know the next line?
Taller than the tallest tree. That's how deep it goes. If it's real.
It was a big day recently on the south side of Chicago, where Lou Rawls was born in 1933, when they held a huge tribute to Lou Rawls Weekend to celebrate the man and his music. Through the magic of giant TV screens and masterful editing, Lou sang one of his favorite hits, Lady Love, for the tens of thousands who gathered.
Right now, we'd like to dedicate this song to all the lovely ladies in the room this evening. Tell you how we feel about you, girls. Hey. Lady love, your love is soothing like a summer's breeze. My lady love, your love is tender as a baby's touch, and you give me all of the things that I need so much. You're my world, lady love. Love. Your love is cooling like the winter snow. My lady love, your love is cozy as a fire's glow. And I keep on needing you, girl, a little more and more. And I thank you, my lady love. You know, it's not easy. Keep love going smooth. People are people, and they all have their moods. But it's so nice to have someone like you who wants a smooth and easy thing and all of the good times.
Nice stuff, huh? Went to see him with my wife, and she said, why can't you sing like him and be, you know, debonair like him? I said, I don't know. I just don't have it, honey. But anyway, I told her I loved her, and it worked out all right in the long run. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is up next, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Lou Rawls.
to have someone like you who wants a smooth and easy thing. So good to be lady love. Sweet lady, my lady, lady love. You got the love I need so much, and I love your tender touch, my lady love. Lady, lady, sweet lady.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to assist the economies of sub-Saharan Africa and to facilitate trade between the region and the United States, the U.S. government initiated in the year 2000 the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. Under the act, regional trade hubs, or technical assistance centers, were created. The USAID trade and investment hubs located in Ghana, South Africa, and Kenya assist, enhance, and broaden the flow of trade between the United States and Africa. The hubs, which are managed by the U.S. Agency for International Development, bring together African and U.S. businesses to attract investment to Africa and promote two-way trade between the United States and African countries, creating jobs and generating income for all of us. The hubs increase regional integration, which creates ever larger markets for U.S. goods and services and improves food security by increasing the movement of food across borders. The hubs also promote two-way trade with the United States under AGOA and facilitate investment and technology to drive trade growth throughout the region as well as globally. In that, they have been spectacularly successful, said USAID West Africa Mission Director Alex Deprez.
Since 2010, USAID's regional trade hubs have facilitated more than $300 million in new finance and investment, almost $1 billion in AGOA exports, and created more than 60,000 new jobs right here in Africa.
Speaking at an AGOA capacity building and skills development workshop in Accra, Ghana, in late April, Director Deprez cited progress in Ghana to illustrate his point.
Here in Ghana, for example, we have a range of wonderful products that are now entering the U.S. market, including cocoa, shea, cashew, and dried mango. An encouraging sign is that these products are often now moving as cocoa butter and cocoa powder instead of beans. Many products are also being exported as soaps instead of shea nut and sold as kernels rather than as raw cashew. Value addition is increasing.
And the future looks because West Africa has a large emerging middle class. The business opportunities to supply this rapidly growing middle class and the markets of the region are enormous, said Director Deprez. The U.S. is committed to Africa, and USAID remains a partner to supporting your efforts to grow and deepen trade relationships.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.